Episode 266 of the Pilot to Pilot podcast takes off now.
Fly with Garmin Avionics? Then grab your mobile device and make the Garmin Pilot app your cockpit companion. Get advanced functions you'll use before, during, and after every flight, including updating your aircraft's databases and logging engine data. Plan, file, fly, log with Garmin Pilot.
The Pilot to Pilot podcast is brought to you by Learn the Finer Points. Use the link below to save 10% off their ground school app. With high-resolution coast-to-coast composite radar and cloud-to-cloud, cloud-to-ground lighting updated every 2.5 minutes along with always-available weather products like METARs, EchoTops, and StormTracks, SiriusXM lets you fly confidently knowing that your weather information is available at 500 feet or at your destination 500 miles ahead. Check out aopa.org/SiriusXM to get a 2-month free trial to try these products out for yourself.
Hi, my name is Joe. I am a 1941 J3 Cub owner, as well as a father of four and an Airbus captain.
Aviation, hello, and welcome back to the Pilot to Pilot podcast. Editor Kevin here, filling in for Justin while he takes a much-deserved vacation. This week's episode is a re-release with Joe Costanza, aka Bananas, with 9 S's on Instagram. I counted for you, so you can look him up. Give him a follow. He's got some great shots. It's a great story that might make you want to get out and do some tailwheel flying, maybe even buy a yellow cub. We will be back again soon with some new content, but thanks again for listening in the meantime. Without any further delay, here's Joe, aka Bananas.
Joe, what's going on, man? Welcome to take 2 of our podcast. We just recorded like 30 minutes of it, and the whole file was corrupted. There's smoke coming out of everything, and it was burned down my whole apartment. You know, it was crazy. That didn't really happen, but the whole file was corrupted, and now we have to start all over again. So you're a champ for putting up with me in these technical difficulties, but welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah. It was so good. We had to do it all again. Well, cool, man. Well, I do the same thing for every episode. You've already been asked this question once, but we're doing it again. Why aviation? What was the original inspiration for you to become a pilot?
I think the original inspiration for me is probably similar to a lot of people. You know, when you're a little kid and you see an airplane, you kind of stop what you're doing and look up, and your parents notice that and they know that you take an interest in aviation, and that kind of started it for me. I'd see an airplane, I'd stop, I'd look at it, or I would be driving to my grandmother's, who lived in Jersey City. So we'd always pass Newark Airport on the turnpike, and that would probably be my favorite part of the trip. Is I'd look out the window and see there was always a DHL 727 that was parked on the ramp there, and I'd see the Continental airplanes taking off, and that was kind of how I got sucked into aviation.
That's like you said, there are a lot of people that look up and see, and they just see the marvelous flying and kind of just fall in love with the magic of it. Did you have anyone in your family that could help kind of guide you around this path? Did you have anyone that was interested in aviation, or were you kind of on your own and blazing your own trail?
Yeah, it's kind of on my own. My family is not really, they don't really take too well to flying. One of my sisters is actually deathly afraid of flying. But my father knew that I wanted to fly, so he kind of helped pursue it with me, mostly financially, but he supported me in it. But yeah, I'm pretty much the only one in my extended family as well that flies airplanes, so it is interesting.
So was that hard for your whole family to kind of wrap their mind around this, be like, you want to be a pilot when we all hate flying? Or are they all kind of like, yeah, Joe, do your thing, bro, just don't ever put me in an airplane?
Yeah, I mean, they were all pretty cool with it, but I do remember when I came back from the small airport that my dad took me to, the first time I ever saw small airplanes, we came back home, and my mom was like, oh, where were you guys? And my father told her where we were, and she was, you know, she was not pleased. I think I was 14 or 15 at the time, and she was not happy.
I would not want to be your dad that day, right?
Yeah, I'm kidding.
That's good that he stuck up for your dream, though, and he was able to help you make it happen.
Yeah, definitely.
So, like you said, a lot of people look up at aviation and they think it's really cool and they want to be a pilot, but not a little amount of those people actually go and become a pilot. You know, there's a lot of hurdles to cross, and it seems a lot harder to get into actual flying. People make excuses whether it's too hard, they're not smart enough, or they just don't know where to get started. How did you get started, and how did you even make this dream become a reality?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, first when I tell them I'm a pilot, the first question they ask is if I'm in the military. And, they're shocked when I tell them that I have a history degree from Rutgers. But I think, what I did, and I think what most people need to do is just go to your local airport. That's what I did. I went with my father to the local airport, and we're looking at the small airplanes on a ramp. And at the time, it was the owner of the flight school. He came out and, hey, can I help you? And my dad, my son is interested in airplanes and maybe learning how to fly one day. And we struck up a conversation, and he ended up actually being the owner of a banner towing company, an aerial advertising company that flew banners over the Jersey Shore. And he said, hey, every summer, we're looking for guys to kind of set up the banners so they can fly over the ocean. And for every hour you work, we'll give you a half an hour towards flight training. And that was kind of all she wrote. I did that for two or three summers, and they were by far the best summers of my life, was setting up the banners in the field and watching the Pawnees and the Satabrias, dive down and pick them up. It was a blast.
Yeah, that's nuts. I saw that for the first time. I think it was in Hyannis the other day, maybe it was like 2 weeks ago now. And I literally thought a plane was just dive bombing toward the ground. I had no idea there was a banner tow setup or anything. I just hear a plane dive bomb and I'm like, what is happening? And then see them pull up. I was like, oh, that's what they do. That's how they do it. And then they go fly slow flight until they're about to run out of fuel and come back in. And
Yeah. It's cool because it's such a, a rudimentary setup. I mean, you have a rope that's attached to the tail of the airplane. They just throw a hook out there, and then they set up the banner on. There's these two copper poles that were probably 5-6 feet in the air, and they had clothesline clips on them, and you just attached the rope, and it was probably not more than 6 feet apart, and then that's it. They would just dive down and keep trying until they picked them up, and then that was it. I mean, it was pretty cool to watch. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's kind of terrifying to think of. Like, it seems like a game they're trying to get as close to the ground as possible, and that's never a game you want to start playing.
No, and that it's funny because that was part of the deal with my mom, is that she said, "Hey, you could learn how to fly, and you could work there as a ground guy, but you have to promise me that you won't ever actually fly the banners." So that was a deal that I made with my mom, and that I kept till this day. So yeah, no banner tone for me. I would just set them up.
Yeah, no thanks. I mean, I'm sure it's fun. It looks fun, but it's like, I'll let you guys have that fun. I'm going to go fly aerial survey and fly a plane that's going to have an engine failure in a couple weeks. But yeah, you can go do that. Yeah, it's funny. Building your time can be some of the best times of your life and some of the worst times of your life. And when you are past that point, you will look back and you'll miss that flying. But during it, you're just trying to like, how do I get out of here ASAP? I need that money, and I need that Spirit money or the major airline money, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because you look back now, like we talked about earlier, you don't realize how much fun you're actually having. Because at the time, all you're thinking about is just, the hours in the logbook, and you just want to start, I don't want to teach another student. I don't want to do another aerial survey. I just want to get out of here and go fly an RJ or go fly Airbus or Citation, whatever it is. And, I tell guys this all the time, just trust me, you'll look back one day and you will miss those days dearly when you're just putting around in a 172 or doing survey work or stuff like that. That's definitely one of those things where you don't appreciate it until it's gone.
Yeah, 100% agree. Because it's rare for even airline pilots that are making tons of money to get back into aviation. Because believe it or not, it's still expensive for them. Like, they still don't want to pay that money to go up and fly a 172, a 206, 182, or even buy an airplane. That is, there are a decent amount that do it, but it's still, it's probably more than 50. It's probably like 70-30 on people that still fly GA, and 30% being the ones that do fly and 70% being the ones that don't fly.
Yeah, and it's funny because I'll fly with guys and they'll be like, oh, no, I don't want to get back in GA. Single engine airplane, it's like an emergency every flight and the liability and this and that. And I'm like, it's like anything else. I mean, you can get killed walking across the street. It doesn't mean you shouldn't have fun. So,
yeah, and it's also interesting how many guys, girls, whoever it is, at their dream job who kind of fallen out of love with aviation. It's more of a job for them, where it's more of getting to point A to point B, and it's not really like to go fly. I'm sure you experience that too, just like I do. Maybe they've been jaded by the industry. Maybe these ups and downs have kind of taken the true love out of aviation, but I've seen a lot of people who just don't love it anymore, and it's just a job to them.
Yeah. And you fly with these guys that are just pretty grumpy and they're just miserable at everything. And it's just, it's sad because at one point they were that little kid looking up at the airplane saying, "Now this is what I want to do." And now they're, angry at everything, and they're yelling at the flight attendants, they're yelling at the gate agents. I mean, they're just really miserable to fly with, so that's not fun.
Well, they might be yelling at people for different reasons over at Spirit.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. That's the only dig I'll have. I don't know anything about Spirit. I've actually heard that the camaraderie and kind of the pilot group at Spirit, and even between them and management, it's actually a really cool place to work. Just there always seems to be some kind of headline. If they can just get away from those headlines and kind of rebrand themselves and get away from that, I feel like the sky's the limit almost.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame because we were actually doing a really good job of getting our reputation kind of back to where it needed to be. And then we just had this recent, call it an IT issue. It was probably a bunch of issues. But yeah, I mean, it's tough. I know, you know, Delta had one in Easter and Southwest had it. And of course, we just had it. And I feel like Spirit is kind of the media's punching bag, so they're going to be a little harder on us.
Yeah,
but sure. I mean, it's frustrating for passengers, so I certainly don't blame anybody that's angry at Spirit or, you know, anybody if we ruin their vacation. So it's tough. And, you know, the other thing too is, you know, a year and a half ago, I don't think there was an airline pilot out there except for the real senior guys that weren't concerned about their career because we thought, oh man, this pandemic is going to destroy everything. And then it came roaring back, and it's tough because you want to be able to add as many flights as you can and grow, but it's just very hard to spool everything up. You know, not only pilot and flight attendant wise, but airport infrastructure, you know, wise and all that stuff. So it's been a really big challenge to go from flying whatever it was, 150 flights a day, 100 flights a day to kind of where we are now. So
yeah, it's crazy. It's like a blessing and a curse at the same time. It's like, thank you so much for everyone wanting to go fly again and we can make money. But it's like, how do we not piss off so many people that they never want to fly with us again because we just can't accompany all these airplanes or all these flights? You know, it's like a very balancing act right now. And it's almost as difficult for management at a lot of places to figure that out than it was to figure out the pandemic.
Yeah, it's 100%. It's so it's, you know, fortunately everything seems to be back to normal for now. For us, I just got off a trip late last night and everything was on time and people weren't angry and our cancellations I think today were like 1% or something like that. So it looks like it's finally back on track.
Good. Just avoid San Juan for a little bit.
Yeah, I know. I had a trip that was supposed to go to San Juan and I just swapped that. I said, no, just in case.
Yeah, no thanks. Don't leave the airplane. Yeah, I'm good. But like you said, every airline kind of has that issue. And I mean, what was it, United or was it Republic technically that dragged one of the people off the airplane and they had their punching bag for a little bit. So now it's just your turn. So
yeah,
hopefully that'll pass.
Yeah, or hopefully some other airline has a meltdown so they can be the media's punching bag. But, you know, like you said, it's kind of funny because when the airline goes through that type of stuff on all, you know, every airline and every base has their own WhatsApp groups and WhatsApp chats and stuff. So it's kind of funny because I feel like the more stuff you go through as a pilot group, the kind of closer everybody becomes.
For sure.
So yeah, it's hopefully behind us. So we'll see.
I've always been interested with Spirit because I've always wanted to know the vibe because everyone thinks you have to go fly at a major airline. And when I say everyone, like that was kind of everyone's goal when they're coming up. And I'm not trying to say Spirit's not a major airline or kind of disrespect anyone's other job, but the public opinion is always like, oh, well, when are you going to go fly for United, Delta, or American? And it's kind of hard for your friends or even kind of like your dream when you were a flight instructor was to work for a big three or do fly a big overseas airplane, international wide body captain, that kind of thing. What's the overall vibe at Spirit? Is it, do people want to stay? Do people look for other jobs? Is it kind of a mixed match? Like, what's it look like?
So it's interesting because it everybody's different. You know, when I was growing up, I wanted to be an L-10, 11 captain for Eastern. So obviously that's a lot different from where I am now.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's weird because you're going to have the guys that always want to fly long haul international. And obviously the Spirit doesn't do that. Or do I think they're going to do that? So I don't think those types will ever really be happy at Spirit. But as far as like the work group goes, I mean, you know, it's a very hands-off airline. So, you know, they tell you how they want you to fly the airplane. This is what they expect from you, but they don't micromanage you, if that makes sense. I mean, it's great. You show up with a brand new, Airbus A320 Neo. I think we actually have the youngest fleet in the industry as far as Airbus goes. And you go fly around for 3 or 4 days and you visit different cities and you go out with the crew, get barbecue, get a beer, you know, whatever. And that's it. You set the parking brake and then you go home. Nobody really ever bothers you. If you mess up, like most airlines, as long as you're honest, if you don't lie, you don't steal, I mean, you'll kind of always have a job, which is nice. But you'll fly with guys that were at DHL or they were at Pan Am, and they are above and beyond grateful to be a Spirit captain, and they have 10, 15 years left and they're not going anywhere and they're happy. And then you have guys that, you know, got hired in 2010 at an RJ job after a year, and then got hired at Spirit 2 years later. And they just kind of expect that their career progression is always going to be like that. Mm-hmm. And I feel like some of those guys, you know, I'm going to be a FedEx captain in 5 years, or I'm going to go to Delta or this or that. So I think it kind of depends on a lot of people's background, and kind of if they're happy at Spirit. When I got hired at Spirit, I was 30, I want to say 30-ish. And I didn't really have plans to leave. And then once we were going to our contract negotiations back in 2015, and I think I was a third or fourth year Airbus captain. I think at the time my pay rate was like $131 an hour. And that's for an Airbus captain. And that's what like United FOs were making. So that was really kind of frustrating. And then fast forward to a new contract, and you know, my hourly rate now is more money than I ever thought I'd actually make flying an airplane. So that's kind of nice. And the way I look at it is there's always going to be someone that's making more money than you.
For sure.
I mean, I would love to have Delta 777 captain pay. But I don't know if I would ever leave Spirit to go pursue that. And again, you know, Atlantic City to Myrtle Beach is probably about as long a flight as I want to do.
Oh, well, so, that was perfect.
Yeah, that works out perfect for me.
It's hard to make the Delta 777 money when you want to fly from Atlantic City to Myrtle Beach.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, everybody's different. You know, I fly with guys that I've flown with captains. I don't think I've flown, I've been a captain since our new contract, but the previous contract I flew with captains that left to go to Delta, one that went to Southwest. So, you know, some people just, they want different things, and I don't fault anybody for that. But, you know, there's very few people that I've met that are truly unhappy at Spirit or JetBlue as a low-cost carrier. Southwest, I know everybody that works at Southwest, they love it. But again, those guys are pretty busy. They work a lot. They get paid really well, but that's the type of flying that I don't know if I would be happy with. But you never know. I mean, who knows?
Yeah, it's one of those things, the grass isn't always greener and money's not the most important thing. It's like, yeah, being a Delta 777 captain is like you're making more money than your pilot ever thought they would, but the process of getting there is an issue. Like that's like your last 5 years most of the time at an airline. You know, that's not like the industry norm, I would say, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy because I have friends that got hired at Delta, and I think at one point, 2 or 3 years ago, I think they were holding like MD-80 or whatever is MD-88, 90 captain before they're even done with training. So, I mean, it was just, it's such a cyclical industry. It's just crazy how quickly things change. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, you look at some of those contracts for like FedEx and UPS, especially, and then I guess you could say Delta's probably the pinnacle of the passenger yeah. flying, but my United friends probably won't be happy that I said that, but, but yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the whole package is great. The retirement, the pay, the go to Paris, you know, 1 month and then go to India the next month. I mean, that's pretty cool. So I could definitely see that appeal to other people, but, yeah. You know, you also have to be given that opportunity. I mean, if you never get hired at those airlines, you kind of don't have a choice either, you know?
Yeah, you're not wrong. And, that is a big issue for her because Delta doesn't hire anyone. Delta can be pretty picky. I know the pilot shortage that's coming up or that is here now, maybe they'll start hiring more. Like, I mean, more people be hiring, but they definitely hire a type of pilot. That's for sure.
Yeah, they do. And you know, we kind of joke because I think, you know, Delta kind of has that. Every airline has their stereotypical, like you said, pilot. So it is kind of funny because you see them in the terminal. They're always, you know, dressed super sharp, super professional with their double-breasted jackets. And it's just kind of funny. And then you have, you know, my pilot crew, so it's a little scrappier. But, you know what? Everybody's got their great, good and bad guys and girls. So yeah, it's, you know,
absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about your path to get to where you are today. So what we know so far is you always want to be a pilot. You were a banner boy. You got 30 minutes of flight instruction for every hour you worked, which probably doesn't sound like enough to pay for your private pilot license. So I'm guessing you had to do some other funding for that. But talk a little bit about flight training, the struggles you had, and just kind of coming up to CFI and where you are now.
Yeah, it was tough. My parents paid for most of my flying up until I think it was my instrument, and then to get my commercial and multi, it just, at the rate at which my parents were willing to pay, it just would have taken me forever. So I took out some loans. I guess they were considered student loans at the time. It's funny because I paid off those and my college loans not all that long ago. But it helped me kind of get everything quicker, because I feel like, especially in flight training, if you fly 1 hour every week, it's kind of tough to progress. So the flight school that I worked at, I worked on the front desk, like a scheduler type thing, receptionist, you could say. So when I got all my ratings there, and then it was kind of a mutual agreement where if you got all your ratings there and your CFI, then you could get off the desk as a quote unquote dispatcher and become a flight instructor. So that's what I did. And it was nice because I knew the operation. The flight school was owned by an American Airlines captain. And this guy was like, he retired like number three at American, and he lived just the epitome of airline pilot, you know, jet age, just really, really perfect timing. He was a A300 captain for American. Good guy. And he ran a really, really tight, well-run flight school. The airplanes were kept in great, great shape. So it was nice because it kind of set the standard for me on what to expect from smaller flight schools and small airplanes and how they should be maintained. So I flight instructed for, I want to say, it was 537 hours. It was probably a year and a half, I guess, before I got hired. My first airline job, which was Colgan, flying a Saab, a Swedish twin turboprop. And yeah, I was based out of Albany and Allentown. And that was
it's everyone's dream, right?
Yeah, that was quite the experience.
Yeah, so 537 hours. Like, you just memorize that number. That's just you. All the horror hours you had of students trying to kill you was 537.
Yeah, it's. I still keep a paper logbook, and I, you know, it's has the reason why I know that number is because it has, you know, flight instructor or hours as flight instructor. And once I got my CFI back in the day, I stopped doing it once I got hired at Colgan. So every single page, I just kept seeing that number over and over again. So that's why I remembered it.
So you still log every flight you fly?
Every single flight. Even, you know, like this morning I went up and I probably flew for 20 minutes, and I'll put, you know, 0.3 in the logbook.
Jeez. Is it just because kind of like that's what you always did, or are you just like having a logbook to keep track? It's kind of like a diary for flying, and people can look back on it and see what you did and where you did and for how long you did. What's the point?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's kind of that. And I don't, you know, I have four daughters, and I don't know if one day, hopefully one of them will want to fly, or maybe all of them will want to fly. But who knows, maybe one day when dad's gone, they'll look through the logbook, or maybe when I'm old and gray and can't fly anymore, I'll look through it. But I don't know. I like having those paper logbooks, yeah, I have just in case.
So are you like, so my dad, he's 64, about to turn 65 next year, last year flying, but he still has that little red logbook that he logs every single flight. Do you have one of those too?
I used to keep those little red, like those crew logbooks, but yeah, I don't. I just put them in the big paper log, the big professional
pilot. Yep. Yeah. Do you bring that with you on your flights, or do you wait till you get home?
No, I don't. No, I end up looking at, like, we have an app, and I just, you know,
it's, yeah,
I get a generic tail number, you know, Airbus, and that's pretty much it.
That's funny. I can see you pulling out, like, after you land, pulling out this huge logbook. Be like, oh, what's your name, Captain? Again, can you sign this one?
Yeah.
I have all my PICs, or I guess you're the PIC, but I want my SICs in the book. What's your name, man?
put my 0.3 of instrument time in there, you know.
How many clouds did we fly through? What do you think that was?
But you know what's kind of funny is I looked through my logbook the other day, and I think I have like, let's say 1600 hours of turbine PIC. But I remember, you know, coming up, you would just about kill someone for an hour of multi-engine time.
Oh,
you know,
my gosh, yes.
And then, you know, and you would pay a lot of money for it. And now it's like, here you are getting paid to go fly, you know, if you want 6-8 hours a day in this, you know, 180,000 pound jet. So it's just, it's funny how it changes.
Multi-engine time is king. If you have a way to get multi-engine time, by all means, get it as fast and as much as you can, because that rules the world.
Absolutely.
It's insane. And then once you get the multi-engine time, they're like, well, we actually want turbo or turbine PIC time. It's like, what, man, what the heck? I can't win. Like, I got you the multi time and now you want this. It's like, make up your mind. What do you want?
Now they want glass time and all that other stuff.
Like, it just feels like you never get there. And that was like a constant thing for me, is I felt like when I was in my aerial survey days, it just felt like the goal was so far down the road. It was just like, you felt like you were stuck in this very low paying job. You weren't going to get out of it. And there's almost no end in sight. You just saw other people living the life, living the dream. And it kind of felt like it was too far away and it was never going to actually happen.
I mean, it's tough because it's an industry where, for a profession where, you know, you're going to have to quote unquote eat shit for a really long time and not make any money. And it's tough because you're doing it at an age where most of your friends are starting out as, you know, young professionals, and they're starting to make money and buy nice cars and buy a house and get married. And you're just like, I don't even know where I'm going to get my next car payment from, you know? So it's kind of tough. And you know, I started out as an instructor and probably made $15 an hour, which equated to probably $12,000 for the first year. And then I got hired at Colgan, thinking I was this big, bad airline pilot flying a turboprop. And that year, I think I made $16,000.
Jeez.
And then I was, an FO at ExpressJet for 7 or 8 years. And I think I topped out at like $35 an hour. So I was, you know, if it wasn't for my wife, who's, or girlfriend, she's my wife now, she was doing pharmaceutical sales. But if it wasn't for her, I'd be a 30-year-old professional pilot living with my mom and dad. And it's just, you know, living in the Northeast, I mean, there's just no other way to make it happen.
Yeah, and that is not the definition of living the dream.
Not at all.
But
it's a nightmare.
It was a reality. And now I feel like regionals do pay enough. Like, you're not going to find yourself falling into that, but you can make decent money as a regional pilot where you can live a life and kind of do what you want to do and have a little bit of spending money, which is good, but it's still like, you still have that goal dangled in front of you. We're seeing the Delta 777 captain with three boats and profit sharing that can buy him a rental property and all that kind of stuff.
I mean, it's insane. I have some friends tell me that, I don't know if it was like last year or the year before. So whenever the Delta retired the 777, I guess they had to, forget exactly how the guys, they got typed in the A350 or whatever it was, but then the A350 didn't come on property, but they were like pay protected. So you had some of these Delta guys are making like $600,000, $700,000. I mean, it was just insane. So it's kind of mind blowing how much money there is to be made, not for everybody, but you know, for a certain few at the airlines, it's pretty wild.
Yeah, it's insane. And you brought up a really good point. And this was a struggle for me, was, coming up in the industry, working that crappy job, the second crappy job, to get to the job you actually wanted, and your friends are balling out, or what they think is balling out. They're making decent money for a 20 to 25 year old in that range. And like you said, buying cars, and you're just like, I just need like a car payment, like any car. Yeah. I can't go buy a new car. It's like, I literally have to live with my parents or have my sugar mama or sugar daddy pay for everything, if it's your husband or wife. But like, it's rough, and it can be really tough to see that. But it's important to know that and it comes so much quicker than you think. Like, it seems like it's so far away, but there comes a point where you finally just like realize, I did it, I'm making money. And it's really ironic because you're like, but I had more fun flying when I was broke. It's kind of like a really funny thing that happens in your career.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I went from making those $35 an hour at ExpressJet, and I got hired at Spirit. And I think the first year was like $30 an hour, which ended up being the same thing as an Express FO. And then second year pay, I'm like, oh, this is great. You know, I can afford food. And then I upgraded to captain, and then we got a new contract. So in a matter of like 4 years, I went from $35 an hour to almost $240 an hour. So it happens quick. Hopefully it continues. But it's funny because the reason, you know, every guy's like, oh, you let your CFI expire, how could you do that, blah blah blah. But at the time, I think it was like $80 to renew it. And at the time, I just didn't have $80. I mean, it's pretty sad when you think about it, but it was either, you know, pay for gas in the car or renew my CFI. Well, I have an airline job, so I'm not gonna need my CFI. I'm just gonna let it expire. And I did. And obviously that was a huge regret, and I got it back 2 months ago. But that kind of goes to show how bad things were at the time, where I couldn't afford to renew my CFI. So it's wild. And now, you know, like you said, you know, when I was probably late 20s and working at ExpressJet, and I loved the job, but it was frustrating. And I got a little bitter when I saw my friends kind of buying houses, and I really couldn't afford anything. And the industry, as you know, it's just so cyclical, and we were furloughing guys. So it's you got to stay the course, but it is tough. It's really tough. But you know, the other thing too is timing is everything. And there are guys that graduated college, flight instructed for a year, got hired at, let's say, Republic and flew there for a year or two, and then got hired at Delta, and they won't ever see anything other than just, you know, crazy career progression. But you know, then you fly with guys that were at Eastern, Pan Am, DHL, and they just got beat up through the industry. So it's just, you know, it's a ton of luck is involved in the industry, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's all about timing. 100%, it's all about timing. And last year really showed, it reminded even me, and it was funny, before this all kind of went down, my dad and I did a podcast together, and we talked about how we never thought the industry would really have a true bottom like it has in the past. Like, all we see is it just going up, up, and up, and up. And it's really hard to tell that, like, a downturn could be very bad and where furloughs could ever happen. And then coronavirus happened, and we're both like, wow. Like, you really cannot predict this industry at all. This industry is so cyclical, and you don't know what's going to cause that bottom, but there's always going to be some sort of bottom. And yeah, it's going to be a little pilot shortage coming up, and it's going to be really good times, but this has just gone on to show that there's still going to be instances where you're going to have to figure it out. You're going to have to hold on for the ride and hope for the best. And whether the next one might be airlines trying to go single pilot or whatever it could be, there's always going to be some kind of hiccup in the future that could affect how great. Because when this industry is great, nothing beats it. Nothing beats it. When it's bad, nothing's worse. So, I mean, there's probably a lot of things that are worse, but it's really bad.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, when COVID first started to happen, we were flying completely empty airplanes, and we'd have to call up dispatch so they could reset the weight and balance. And you could hear it in, you know, the dispatcher's voice, you know, the FO's voice, my voice. We were just so defeated, and we're like, this is it, you know. And at the time, you're like, man, I didn't realize how much I actually love my company, my job, you know, my position, because the thought of it going away was just soul crushing. And, you know, the airlines are tough because it's all seniority based system. And you can be a 20-year Airbus captain, and they don't care. You'll go right back to being a ERJ 145 FO. I mean, that's just how it is.
Your number,
so is absolutely. Yeah, it was scary.
Their number one job is keep the airline running and paying off their investors or whoever they need to pay off.
Yeah,
they do not care about Joe in Atlantic City flying to Little Beach. It's like, sorry,
not
bro.
At all.
Yeah, enjoy that cub. Hopefully, you paid it off by now.
Yeah, exactly, man. They do not. You know, it's all about shareholder value.
Yeah. Which, yeah, it's the game. It is the game. And like we said, when the good times, you're going to make a ton of money.
Yeah, it's, you know, hopefully, you know, like you said, you know, you think you've seen the worst, but there's always something, in the future that can be a pretty big threat.
Yeah, and it usually seems to be right when you start saying, like, man, life's really good. You know, like, it's finally good.
Always.
And then literally the next day, you're like, what the? Why did I say that? It's like when you're in an airplane, you're like, what's the worst that could happen? It's like, well, surprise.
Surprise. There goes your number
surprise.
One engine.
Surprise. Yeah. It's gone. And your hydraulics are gone. Yeah, it's a crazy industry, and it's a sickness almost, like the love you have for it and how you need to do it, and how a lot of times pilots that don't fly, their significant others can't be around them. You know, it's like people need flying to be, it's like a drug. You need it to keep going in life and to kind of have people enjoy your presence. Cause if you're not flying, there's a lot of instances where I've seen it. Even my dad, my mom's like, you need to get out and go fly. Like, go leave.
Yeah.
Like, go do something.
Yeah. I mean, I'm home a lot. I mean, I'm home an awful lot, but there's times where my wife is like, I can just tell she's looking at me, and in the back of her mind, she's just thinking, you have to get out of the house before I stand you. So
that's really funny.
Yeah.
Well, hey, let's take a quick break real quick and hear from today's sponsor, RAA.
Did you know there are 3 action steps you can take to protect yourself in a volatile market? Volatility in the market can make the best investor a little nervous and take actions that they know they normally wouldn't. It can be stressful, and you may be thinking, shouldn't I be doing something though? Well, the answer is yes. The first and maybe the most important action you can take is to resist the urge to make decisions based on recent market movements alone. This is tough, but will pay off in the long run. Next, if you're feeling stressed in this market, it may be time to review your risk tolerance and your ability to take a loss in downturns. We all like to think we can take the risk up until the point where we actually see fluctuations in our portfolio. And lastly, get a second opinion on where you stand financially so you can take a longer-term view of the market in your financial plan. Not sure where to start? RAA can help. Founded by pilots for pilots and with 4 decades of financial planning and investment management experience, RAA is intimately familiar with unique benefits, risks, and career timelines that pilots face. Whether you're early in your career as a pilot or you spent years flying the line, RAA is here to help navigate your financial journey from takeoff to touchdown. For more pilot-specific planning tips, go to raa.com/pilot-to-pilot. That's pilot, T-O, pilot. And now back to today's episode.
What's the balance like with 4 kids? That's crazy. 4 kids. And I'm guessing they're pretty young still, right?
Yeah, they're nine, 5, and I have identical twin girls. Well, they're all girls, but identical twin girls that are 2.5.
Oh, wow.
So it's...
Surprise.
Yeah, we went for the boy, number 3. We ended up with 2 girls. So,
jeez.
it's really, really busy. And thank God my wife is just... I mean, she's superwoman. She's really unbelievable. Not only because she's taking care of the kids all the time, but she allows me to go fly the cub every day. So
yeah,
she's cool. She's a good one.
Talk about how your values or like how you have changed through this process. Like before, I'm sure you would rank like your loves, like your wife flying probably 1 and 2. And then now you have your kids and kind of how you value your time. Did you work less to be around family? Do you work the same amount? Kind of like how do you juggle all of having kids, having family, flying, doing all that, especially with 4 kids now? Like it's just shocking.
So it's funny. You know, my wife's like, you know, you go flying all the time. And I do. But I say it's a sacrifice, but I mean, I'm up every day at 4:35 in the morning so I can go to the airport and I can fly and then get back to the house before the kids are up. So, you know, I try to make sure that there's obviously enough time for the family and cub flying and my wife. But I try to do the majority of my flying early in the morning for a lot of reasons. But, you know, I would not be able, nor would I think it's appropriate for me to go flying, you know, in the middle of the day, every single day for hours on end, because that just wouldn't be fair to anybody. But it's nice because, you know, it's a cub, so I can really only carry one other person. But my girls do like going flying with me, so that's nice. That's fun. But yeah, I probably would have been better off with like a Cherokee 6 or something. But
future goals, you know, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I need a caravan with all my kids, but but yeah.
You might need the EX, the big one.
Yeah, I know. But you know, it was nice too about Spirit, and I think some other airlines too. I'm not sure how their contracts work, but I mean, you can work as little or as much as you want, and just the schedule flexibility is just really, I mean, to me, that's the most valuable thing. Is you can drop. You know, if there's reserve coverage, which in our base there usually is, I mean, you could just drop 2-3 weeks on end. And I mean, it's great to have that ability to kind of unwind a little bit and kind of detach yourself from work, especially when things are going crazy and, you know, a meltdown, so to speak, just kind of step away and just kind of relax at home. So that's nice.
So you said your girls like flying with you. Did they like getting up at 4:30 in the morning to go fly in the cub?
No, so it's funny. I'll go flying early in the morning, and then I'll usually go again, you know, right after dinner, and that's usually when they'll come up with me. Yeah. When it's a late afternoon flight. So
does your wife
works
like
out
fun?
Pretty well? She does. When we first started dating, her family has a beach house in Ocean City, New Jersey, oh, and cool. There's actually a little airport there. And I would fly instruct out of North Jersey, so we would take the 172 and fly it down occasionally for the weekend. So that was a lot of fun, but. It kind of sounds morbid, but we try not to fly together too often now, just in case something happens.
I get it. Yeah. It's those other things you got to start thinking about when you have kids. It's like, I don't know if we should do this.
Exactly. Yeah,
it's awful to think about, but like you said, it's flying.
I know.
There are inherent risks to flying every day you go up and it's unfortunate part of our industry and it happens and you don't ever know what's going to happen to.
Yeah, no. And that's like, you know, the recent crash with Snodgrass. I mean, you know, if somebody like that's got 6,000 hours in an F-14 and it's just a decorated pilot. If something like that could happen to him, I mean, it could happen to anybody. So it's, you know, it's scary.
So I flew freight at, it was called Priority Air Charter. It was at, based at Northeast Ohio. It was a family run place. They have their own private airport up in pretty much Amish town, Ohio. Like it is literally surrounded by the Amish. It's the craziest thing. Amish kids are walking on the runway. You click the runway lights and they like run off and then they just watch this like magical thing coming and land. And it's wild. But anyways, that company in Basler up in Oshkosh, they are the two companies that are buying up all the DC-3s and converting them into PT-6s. And the owner, there's three brothers that owned it, and one died of cancer and the other one died in a DC-3 crash at the airport a couple of years ago. But the one that died in the crash, he had so much time in a DC-3. He was a great pilot. He flew the DC-3 in Africa for Samaritan's Purse, and he would do a lot of cool stuff over in Africa and has done anything and everything. And he's the person you would want in the airplane if anything ever happened. And unfortunately, something did happen and they succumbed to it. And it's just like... It's just a situation. Like that doesn't mean he's a bad pilot. It was just a situation that happened, and it's just aviation to unfortunate coming out. I don't know the right word to say. It's just, it's crazy. Like you never know when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen, but it doesn't mean they're a bad pilot or made bad decisions. It's just this terrible situation they were dealt with.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you know, you try to make sure you don't put yourself in a bad position, you know, make sure you're like even like stupid little things like, should I take off from intersection departure, use the full runway, stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, you never know. I mean, really never, there's a really good book, Fate is the Hunter.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's one of those things you just never know.
Well, what's crazy is I had an engine failure in a 206 and we landed on the mountains of West Virginia. And I still have superstitions that I will not take in any plane. So it's like that day, I remember I had cold pizza in my bag and it was like my snack to eat in the plane, and I will never fly with pizza on an airplane ever again. And I know it's really stupid, but it's just it's just like in the back of my mind, or it's just a superstition that I have where it's just like I don't feel comfortable having cold pizza on an airplane, which is absolutely ridiculous, but it's just kind of how I am now.
It makes perfect sense though. That's the thing.
It's wild. Yeah, it's absolutely insane. All right, going back to kind of your story, so Spirit, well, I guess what I wanted to say was you've kind of jumped around, not like a bad thing, but you've moved on to bigger or better opportunities. Whenever the opportunity, it sounds like, came up to have a better job, you weren't afraid to do it. There are a lot of people that go to a job and they stay there for a while. And whether that's good or bad, you know, you never know. Like some jobs are great, but they don't take the risk to move on for the greater goal. What do you say to someone that maybe is at a regional and is just like, well, you know, I'm a captain here, I'm making decent money, I don't know if American will ever call me, or like, they're not taking that next step. What do you say to someone, since you yourself has had the experience of taking those next steps to get to the job you've always wanted?
Yeah, it's kind of those, we had a bunch of those guys. We call me the golden handcuffs because they were making pretty good money and a good schedule. But as far as the airlines go, I mean, if you're not selling your own tickets, I think it's a really, really risky thing to kind of hang your hat there. I think any fee for departure airline, and some work out better than others, like SkyWest seems like it'll be around forever. But look at Comair. Comair, you thought would be around forever too. And I think, you know, it was unfortunate, but I was also fortunate in that I wasn't making any money. So it was very easy for me to just say, hey, I'm going to go pursue other airlines. But I think the biggest thing, and you see it with a whole bunch of different airline pilots or guys that are making a lot of money, it's kind of, you want to put yourself in a position to where you're saving enough money to where if you need to make a jump, whether it's lateral or even if it seems like a step backwards, to where you can live off of your savings for a little bit, because you have guys that have, you know, car payment, ex-wife, a boat, and they're making 350 grand a year and they still have no money. So that's, you know, it's not what you make, it's what you spend. So I think until you're at your final destination, which you never really know what that'll be, but if it's the airlines and it's a legacy airline, I mean, you really got to make sure you're saving up as much money as you can until you get to that spot. And even if you do get to that spot, I mean, there was guys that had just gotten to United and then COVID happened and then they got stuck around a year or so making way less than minimum guarantee.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's one of those things you got to, you know, the end justifies the means, and if you want to be an airline pilot, you should really try to make the jump to an airline that sells its own tickets. Because everything that I've seen, I mean, that's really the only way to have a somewhat secure career.
Even like that goes with like time building. So a lot of times I always tell people, and this might sound bad, but you don't owe the people where you are anything. It's like they hired you to fly an airplane and they are making money off of you in that way. It's like, don't let them pressure you into thinking that you have to stay there. And that can happen a lot. And it's very real because they don't want to lose anyone and have to go through the retraining business, but you need to keep taking that next step. It's like, yeah, being a chief pilot at this really small 135 might be fun, but like, you need to try to keep going, whether it's to go to a great fractional like I'm at, or whether it's to go to Spirit and then eventually an airline, or to stay at Spirit. Like you need to, you don't owe that certain carrier anything, and you need to unfortunately look out for yourself.
Yeah, I remember when I was flying with the captain at Express and I mentioned to him that I got hired at Spirit, and he's like, oh, you're crazy. You're a couple months away from upgrade. You want to get your 1,000 hours of turbo PIC. And to me, I mean, I thought he was out of his mind, but he thought I was crazy for leaving to go to Spirit. And, you know, it's one of those things. I mean, now I'm an eight year captain at Spirit. And I think the last time I heard was like, it's not an Uber driver for groceries, but it's one of those things, you know? Yeah. So, and I'm sure he'll bounce back, you know, he'll get up on his feet and get another airline job. But I mean, clearly, you know, staying at ExpressJet wasn't the right thing to do. So, and it's one of those things in the air as a professional pilot, you know, everybody asks if you're making the right move and they're like, I'll let you know on the day that I retire. I mean, it's very hard to predict in this industry if you made the right move.
Yeah. It's like people that are leaving regionals to go to, what is it? Breeze Airways. It's like, yeah, in 30 years, if Breeze becomes what JetBlue was, you probably made a great decision, but the chances of that actually happening might be relatively slim. But I mean, if it's worth the risk to you and your family, then by all means, go for it. People are going to judge you. We have so many Monday morning quarterbacks, even in my career. I mean, I know I played football, but like outside of that, it was going where I was and people were like, why aren't you going to a regional? Why aren't you going to the major route? It's like, this is what I think would be the best for my career and my family. And if that's the decision that you make at the end of the day, it's kind of like you with Spirit. This is the best right now for you and your family. So you will be happy there and you don't have to worry about what other people say.
Yeah, I mean, you could, Spirit could end up like Skybus, right? But it could end up like Southwest or could stay the same. But I mean, I'd rather regret doing something than regret not doing something. So, you know, we'll see.
Well, if we're going to play that game, it's like, well, cool. American could be in the next TWA, you know, it's like, or PSA. You don't know. Like, we literally have no idea what this industry will look like in 10 years from now.
Yeah. Yep.
It's a good especially point. With supersonic jets possibly coming or whatever the future might look like the aviation could, you never know what the future holds. So just buckle up, hold on tight and make the best decision for you and your family and your loved ones.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk about, I love your social media. Your pictures are unbelievable. And
thanks, man. Thanks.
I made fun of your name a little bit in the first time we did, but it's bananas with multiple S's.
Nine to be exact.
Nine S's. And we talked about how you just had to have the name bananas and that's how many S's it took to get it, right?
That is correct. Yeah. I don't know why I originally came up with bananas. I really don't, because it was so long ago when I started the Instagram and then I kind of was off it for a really long time. Then I signed back on and I'm like, well, I guess this is my name. It is what it is. But it works out because I guess bananas are yellow and the cub is yellow and the Spirit's yellow. So it kind of just makes sense now.
It's perfect. It was like it was meant to be. It was like when you made this Instagram account, it was going to it predicted your whole future. Little did you know. But your videos are sick, man. Like I'm watching one right now and you just look like you're having so much fun. The colors on it are great. Like you're just truly loving aviation and I love to see it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just something about, you know, maybe it's because what we do professionally is just so structured and there's so many, you know, you have to fly the airplane how they want you to fly it. And you have to do this checklist and you got to call for pushback and the passengers and all these sophisticated systems. And then you look at the cub wherever you got to hand prop it. There's no electronics. It's just pure stick and rudder and grass strips. I mean, it's really so much fun. And it's like we talked about earlier, you know, aviation's like drugs. I mean, this flying the cub is literally, it's like, it's meditative. It's therapeutic. I mean, it's awesome.
I'm just like blown away by some of your camera angles too. It's the slow motion of the tire meeting the grass. Like that's so cool. Like, yeah. Where did you mount that?
it's mounted on like a strut and has like a little carbon fiber pole that comes down. But it's, you know, I'm glad that I do all this stuff early in the morning, because otherwise people would probably be like, what is this idiot doing taxiing around with these things hanging off his airplane, you know?
Yeah, this guy thinks he's a social media star. Look at this idiot.
Yeah, look at this idiot.
Yeah. No, yeah, it's good to get out early in the morning for that. Yeah, but these are sick, man. And your hangar looks so cool. And I guess one question is, why the Cub? What was the kind of inspiration for a Cub? There's so many airplanes you could buy in that price range. What was the Cub? Just like true aviation, like bare bones, real hand flying? Or was there
To me, it's like the epitome of a throwback to that, you know, golden age of aviation when everything was just starting out. Think about the thousands of World War II pilots that learned how to fly in a Cub. I think about aviation and I think about the Cub, and I don't know how people just can't get romantic about it. You know, thinking about the barnstormers of past, and I think the Cub just kind of fits that image. And it's a, you know, inexpensive airplane to own and operate. And it's a blast to fly. It's super forgiving. I mean, it's really slow, so that's kind of tough, but I don't mind.
When you're going to get that $100 hamburger and all the cars are passing you and you could have definitely driven faster. Yeah. It's like, dang it.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough,
but you get to go fast in your little Airbus. So it works out, right?
Yeah. So it balances out.
Yeah. Do you see a future, like faster plane ownership in your future? Or are you kind of a Cub guy for life?
No, I think I'm a Cub guy for life. I don't, the idea of getting in an airplane with my whole family and going somewhere and filing IFR, I mean, that's not appealing to me at all. When I say not at all, I mean, I would avoid that at all costs. Because I feel like I'm at work, but, yeah. A Super Cub would be really fun. I have a couple hours in a Super Cub where I got my tailwheel endorsement up in Airflex Andover. Damien, he's got a Super Cub, but it's a pretty highly modified one. And it was the most fun I've ever had in an airplane, because it could just do whatever you wanted it to do. But it's also, you know, probably five times the price of my Cub.
So yeah, it's insane. You're paying for that.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, this is crazy, man. It's great. And I think it really kind of embodies the love of aviation and just bare bones flying and just having fun. We were talking about this earlier. I think we might have been off the podcast, but unfortunately, your airport's actually closing soon. Am I correct?
Yeah. So the airport, it's been rumored to close for a really long time, but now the zoning has officially been approved. So they want to turn it into affordable housing, or part of the development's going to be affordable housing. So, I mean, that's going to be really tough, because the airport's been around since the 50s. It is privately owned, so he can do whatever he wants with it. I get it, but it's frustrating and sad, because there's, number one, it's a great little airport, but it's also the home to 50 hangars, of course, which one of which is mine. And it's incredibly hard to find hangar space in New Jersey. But even more than that is, I mean, every weekend we're out there, you know, whether it's barbecuing or just talking to each other or hangar flying. So that's kind of tough, because these are people that, you know, I met 2-3 years ago, but now I consider them friends for life.
Yeah.
So it'll be tough when the airport does close, and our guys are going to sell their airplanes, or are they going to move it to a different airport? So that's, you know, that'll be kind of sad, but hopefully we can all figure something out to where they can maybe potentially, possibly, probably not build more hangars at another local airport. But, it's one of those things where I stress about it for so long that at this point I just gotta, you know, kind of
just throw your hands up. Happens. Not much you can do, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, just it's kind of the industry as a whole. It's just kind of like,
exactly,
you can't affect,
right.
You can't, you just got to worry about what you can affect and take one blow as it comes.
Exactly.
Take it day by day.
Yeah.
You'll still have your yellow airplane to go fly and have fun in. Just might have to do it somewhere else.
Yeah. And there's a local airstrip. It's a privately owned grass strip. It's like a 6th generation farmer. He's a really, really great guy. He owns a couple of Cubs, a couple of Stearmans, and he, you know, is willing to make some room for me. So that'd be nice. I have no problem going to a grass strip. It'd be sad if I can't find my current hangar mate has a Mooney. So he obviously won't be keeping his airplane there, but, yeah. We'll see what happens. Aviation's kind of a really small, tight-knit circle. So even if guys move to airports far away, I mean, like you said, there's social media and we can have fly-ins and meetups. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. I got a couple rapid-fire questions for you. So this is just going to be quick answers on your part, just aviation related. You say the first thing that comes to your mind, all right?
Yep.
All right. Well, the first one, this is kind of a new one, so it might be a little longer, but it is, what is the most terrified you've ever been in an airplane?
Somewhat rapid decompressurization at Express Jet probably 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, crap. Yeah.
How'd you realize that was going on? Was it pretty easy to tell, or was it one of the slowly came on, or was it just like, boom?
So I was the FO at the time, and the captain, just all I heard him say was, get your mask on. I had no idea what was going on. So we got my mask on, and then we saw the pressurization climbing, and we got the cabin. But the worst part was that we were flying into Newark, and we had to descend, obviously, but we were descending into some pretty horrendous weather. So that was bad. It ended up being like a stuck outflow valve or something.
Yeah.
But that was probably the most scared I've been in an airplane.
Yeah, I don't want to say I've been there before, but I've been there before.
Yeah.
Descending through the worst weather you could ever imagine, too. It's like, are you freaking kidding me?
Yeah.
It's like, can we just have one emergency, please? I don't need tornadoes right
exactly.
now. Yeah,
exactly.
All right, here we go. Here are the true rapid-fire questions. What's your favorite airplane ever made?
J3.
What's your favorite airliner? It doesn't have to be the one you fly. Just like one you've always looked up to, the L-1011 or whatever, like... What's your favorite?
757.
What is your favorite corporate jet?
Global Express.
What is, really? Wow. You're one of the first people that I've ever said the Global. I appreciate it. Most people just say Gulfstream. It's like when you think people, especially the airline pilot, where they have no idea about anything in general and corporate planes, they're just like, Gulfstream. All right. Here is one that can be controversial. And if you say the wrong answer, I'm going to have to delete everything we just talked about. Again, what is the ugliest airplane you've ever seen?
Oh, I forget the name of it, but I think it's an Air Anka. It looks like a bathtub.
Oh, what?
You know what I'm talking about?
Kind of. We'll have to look that one up.
I'll send you. It's hideous looking. It looks like a little bathtub.
A flying bathtub. Who knew that's what we needed?
Yeah. Yeah.
What is something you wish you knew before you became a pilot?
How much money it would cost.
What's something you... Oh, yeah, I just asked that. No. Who in the industry would you like to meet most? It could be alive or they could have passed on.
Frank Lorenzo.
I do not know who that is. So maybe that's bad.
He's a pretty horrible human being. He was Grand Continental, basically into the ground, and Eastern, I think, the bankruptcy. Yeah. So
why do you want to meet him?
I guess pick his brain. Yeah. He's kind of a horrible human being, so I think it'd be interesting to...
Why are you the way you are?
Family, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Say family.
Yeah. Oh, no, I meant like, would you want to ask him that question? Why are you the way you are? Why did you run?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what I want to ask him. Yeah.
All right, here's another. What's your overall favorite thing about aviation?
Freedom it gives you.
Yeah. Hardest approach you've ever flown?
Probably Bogota or Guatemala.
What's the best thing about owning a J3 Cub?
Simplicity of it.
What's the worst thing?
Slow.
What is your least favorite approach?
Easy. San Jose, Costa Rica.
What's the best day you've ever had in an airplane?
You know what? The day that I took my dad up in my Cub when I bought it.
What's your favorite airport to land at?
Probably Allen's Little Grass Strip, which is right, a little local airport.
Least favorite airport?
Probably Newark LaGuardia.
What is your favorite airport food?
Five Guys. there used to be a place called, in Cleveland, there was a really good sandwich place, Banjo's. It was called Banjo's, and that was probably the greatest airport food ever.
And it's gone?
It's gone.
RIP Banjo's.
Yeah.
IFR or VFR?
VFR.
Would you rather fly over mountains, beaches, or the city?
Mountains.
Airbus or Boeing?
Airbus.
Favorite airline livery?
Probably the old Delta widget one.
Don't worry, a lot of your Delta friends are going to be really mad at you.
Yeah.
Would you rather fly as many or the longest trip you could possibly fly in your Airbus or as many short legs as possible in an Airbus?
Short legs as possible.
Hardest check ride you've ever had?
this initial Saab check ride.
What's the biggest win of your career?
I guess passing upgrade on the Airbus, probably.
Biggest regret of your career?
Maybe not taking it as seriously as I should have when I was younger and should have got hired by a regional probably sooner than I did, maybe.
All right, you are deadheading to your Airbus. Would you rather deadhead on a CRJ or an ERJ? And to make it more fair, we're going to go the CRJ 200 or the Embraer 145.
The ERJ, hands down, because the windows on the CRJ are just, you have to, I mean, I'm short, but you have to almost be like 3 foot tall to comfortably see out the window of a CRJ.
Yeah. What's your favorite airline to fly on as a passenger?
To fly on as a passenger, probably JetBlue.
And last but not least, if you could do it all over again, would you do 141 training or 61?
61.
Joe, those are, well, I have one more question, but those are pretty much all the questions. Thank you for coming on to the podcast. I'm sorry that I had to re-record half this interview with you, but here we are and it was still good. But my last question for you is going to be, someone's listening to this, they love everything you're saying. What is three tips you would give to someone coming up in this industry right now? They're just starting flight school, or maybe they're just becoming a CFI. Just what are three tips into blazing their path into becoming a professional pilot?
Probably number one, don't give up. Number two, listen to as many people, whoever wants to give you advice, listen to it. And number three would be, I guess save a lot of money.
For the bad times?
Yeah. For the bad times, for sure.
And you mentioned this before, don't be a jerk.
Yeah, you know what? That's important, because the guy that is pulling your gear one day could be the guy that you're pulling gear for one day, or the guy that's on the interview board at your next airline. So yeah, that's very,
Joe,
that's key.
Look who it is.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, not good. So yeah. Well, Joe, thanks for so much. Wow. Can't talk. Joe, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, man. I really appreciate it. Thanks for putting up with the technical difficulties and sharing your story. I hope everyone goes to follow you. Bananas with 9 S's. Don't put 10 or 8. It's 9.
There you go.
But yep. It's a great account, and you just truly love aviation. So it's great to see. But man, I hope you're having a great day, and this is coming out tomorrow. So it's a fast turn. So it's going to be fun, and can't wait for people to listen to your story.
Cool, man. Thanks. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Anytime. Thanks, man. Hope you have a great day.
And that's a wrap of episode 266. Thanks again for listening. And as always, happy flying.